Chapter 24. Girl's reproachful shape. Ever at his side, more vividly than in the body, Fulvia Vivaldi became the symbol of his best aims and deepest failure. Sometimes, indeed, her look drove him forth in the Duchess's train, but more often, drawing him from the crowd of pleasure seekers, beckoned the way to solitude and study. Under Crescenti's tuition he began the reading of Dante, who just then, after generations of neglect, was once more lifting his voice above the crowd of minor singers. The mighty verse swept Odo out to open seas of thought, and from his vision of that earlier Italy, hapless, bleeding, but alive and breast to breast with the foe, he drew the presage of his country's resurrection. Passing from this high music to the company of Gamba and his friends was like leaving a church, where the penitential psalms are being sung for the marketplace, where mud and eggs are flying. The change was not agreeable to a fastidious taste, but, as Gamba said, you cannot clean out a stable by waving incense over it. After some hesitation, he had agreed to make Odo acquainted with those who, like himself, were secretly working in the cause of progress. These were mostly of the middle class, physicians, lawyers, and such men of letters as could subsist on the scant wants of an unliterary town. Ablest among them was the bookseller, Andreoni, whose shop was the meeting place of all the literati of Pianura. Andreoni, famous throughout Italy for his editions of the classics, was a man of liberal views and considerable learning, and in his private room were to be found many prohibited volumes, such as Beccaria's Crime and Punishment, Gravina's Hydra Mystica, Concini's History of Probabilism and the Amsterdam editions of the French philosophical works. The reformers met at various places, and their meetings were conducted with as much secrecy as those of the honeybees. Odo was at first surprised that they should admit him to their conferences, but he soon divined that the gatherings he attended were not those at which the private designs of the party were discussed. It was plain that they belonged to some kind of secret association. And before he had been long in Pianura he learned that the Society of the Illuminati, that bugbear of priests and princes, was supposed to have agents at work in the duchy. Odo had heard little of this execrated league, but that it was said to preach atheism, tyrannicide and the complete abolition of territorial rights. But this, being the report of the enemy, was to be received with a measure of doubt. He tried to learn from Gamba whether the Illuminati had a lodge in the city, but on this point he could extract no information. Meanwhile he listened with interest to discussions on taxation, irrigation, and such economic problems as might safely be aired in his presence. These talks brought vividly before him the political corruption of the state and the misery of the unprivileged classes. All the land in the duchy was farmed on the metayer system, and with such ill results, that the peasants were always in debt to their landlords. The weight of the evil lay chiefly on the country people, who had to pay on every pig they killed, on all the produce they carried to market, on their farm implements, their mulberry orchards and their silkworms, to say nothing of the tithes to the parish. So oppressive were these obligations, that many of the peasants, forsaking their farms, enrolled themselves in the mendicant orders, thus actually strengthening the hand of their oppressors. Of legislative redress there was no hope, and the Duke was inaccessible to all but his favorites. The previous year, as Odo learned, 800 poor laborers, exasperated by want, had petitioned His Highness to relieve them of the corvée. But though they had raised 1,500 scudi to bribe the court official who was to present their address, no reply had ever been received. In the city itself, the monopoly of corn and tobacco weighed heavily on the merchants, and the strict censorship of the press made the open ventilation of wrongs impossible, while the Duke's spurii and the agents of the Holy Office could drag a man's thoughts from his bosom and search his midnight dreams. The church party, in the interest of their order, fostered the Duke's fears of sedition, and branded every innovator as an atheist, The Holy Office, having even cast grave doubts on the orthodoxy of a nobleman who had tried to introduce the English system of ploughing on his estates, it was evident to Odo that the secret hopes of the reformers centered in him, and the consciousness of their belief was sweeter than love in his bosom. It diverted him from the follies of his class, fixed his thoughts at an age when they are apt to range, and thus slowly shaped and tempered him for high uses. In this fashion the weeks passed and summer came. It was the Duchess's habit to escape the August heats by retiring to the dower house on the Piana, a league beyond the gates, but the little prince, being still under the care of the German physician, who would not consent to his removal, Her Highness reluctantly lingered in Pianura. With the first leafing of the oaks, Odo's old love for the budding earth awoke, and he rode out daily in the forest toward Pontesordo. It was but a flat stretch of shade, lacking the voice of streams and the cold breath of mountain gorges. A wood without humors or surprises, but the mere spring of the turf was delightful as he cantered down the grass alleys roofed with level boughs, the outer sunlight just gilding the lip of the long green tunnel. Sometimes he attended the Duchess, but oftener chose to ride alone, setting forth early after a night at cards, or a late vigil in Crescenti's study. One of these solitary rides brought him without premeditation to a low building on the fenny edge of the wood. It was a small house, added, it appeared, to an ancient brick front adorned with pilasters, perhaps a fragment of some woodland temple. The doorstep was overgrown with a stealthy green moss and tufted with giant fennel, and a shutter swinging loose on its hinge gave a glimpse of inner dimness. Odo guessed at once that this was the hunting lodge where Sir Venno had found his death. And as he stood looking out across the oozy secrets of the marsh, the fever seemed to hang on his steps. He turned away with a shiver, but whether it were the sullen aspect of the house, or the close way in which the wood embraced it, the place suddenly laid a detaining hand upon him. It was as though he had reached the heart of solitude. Even the faint woodland noises seemed to recede from that dense circle of shade, and the marsh turned a dead eye to heaven. Odo tethered his horse to a bough, and seated himself on the doorstep. But presently his musings were disturbed by the sound of voices, and the Duchess, attended by her gentlemen, swept by at the end of a long glade. He fancied she waved her hand to him, but being in no humor to join the cavalcade, he remained seated, and the riders soon passed out of sight. As he sat there, somber thoughts came to him, stealing up like exhalations from the fen. He saw his life stretched out before him, full of broken purposes and ineffectual effort. Public affairs were in so perplexed a case that consistent action seemed impossible to either party, and their chief efforts were bent toward directing the choice of a regent. It was this, rather than the possibility of his accession, which fixed the general attention on Odo, and pledged him to circumspection. While not concealing that in economic questions his sympathies were with the liberals, he had carefully abstained from political action, and had hoped, by the strict observance of his religious duties, to avoid the enmity of the church party. Tresker's undisguised sympathy seemed the pledge of liberal support, and it could hardly be doubted that the choice of a regent in the church party would be unpopular enough to imperil the dynasty. With Austria hovering on the horizon, the church herself was not likely to take such risks, and thus all interests seemed to center in Odo's appointment. New elements of uncertainty were, however, perpetually disturbing the prospect. Among these was Hale Jenstern's growing influence over the Duke. Odo had seen little of the German physician since their first meeting. Hearsay added that he was close pressed by the spies of the Holy Office, and perhaps for this reason he remained withdrawn in the Duke's private apartments, and rarely showed himself abroad. The little prince, his patient, was as seldom seen, and the accounts of the German's treatment were as conflicting as the other rumors of the court. It was noised on all sides, however, that the Duke was ill satisfied with the results of the pilgrimage, and resolved upon less hallowed measures to assure his heir's recovery. Hitherto, it was believed, the German had conformed to the ordinary medical treatment. But the clergy now diligently spread among the people the report that supernatural agencies were to be employed. This rumor caused such general agitation that it was said both parties had made secret advances to the Duchess in the hope of inducing her to stay the scandal. Though Maria Clementina felt little real concern for the public welfare, her stirring temper had more than once roused her to active opposition of the government, and her kinship with the old Duke of Monte Loro made her a strong factor in the political game. Of late, however, she seemed to have wearied of this sport, throwing herself entirely into the private diversions of her station, and alluding with laughing indifference to her husband's necromantic researches. Such was the conflicting gossip of the hour, but it was in fact idle to forecast the fortunes of a state dependent on a valetudinary's whims, and rumor was driven to feed upon her own conjectures. To Odo, the state of affairs seemed a satire on his secret aspirations. In a private station, or as a ruling prince, he might have served his fellows. As a princeling on the edge of power, he was no more than the cardboard sword in a toy armory. Suddenly he heard his name pronounced, and starting up saw Maria Clementina at his side. She rode alone, and held out her hand as he approached. "I have had an accident," said she, breathing quickly. "My girth is broke, and I have lost the rest of my company." She was glowing with her quick ride, and as Odo lifted her from the saddle, her loosened hair brushed his face like a kiss. For a moment she seemed like life's answer to the dreary riddle of his fate. "Ah," she sighed, leaning on him, "I am glad I found you, cousin. I hardly knew how weary I was," and she dropped languidly to the doorstep. Odo's heart was beating hard. He knew it was only the stir of the spring sap in his veins, but Maria Clementina wore a look of morning brightness that might have made a soberer judgment blink. He turned away to examine her saddle. As he did so, he observed that her girth was not torn, but clean cut, as with sharp scissors. He glanced up in surprise, but she sat with drooping lids, her head thrown back against the lintel, and repressing the question on his lips, he busied himself with the adjustment of the saddle. When it was in place, he turned to give her a hand, but she only smiled up at him through her lashes. "What," said she with an air of lovely lassitude, "are you so impatient to be rid of me? I should have been so glad to linger here a little." She put her hand in his, and let him lift her to her feet. "How cool, and still it is. Look at that little spring bubbling through the moss. Could you not fetch me a drink from it?" She tossed aside her riding hat, and pushed back the hair from her warm forehead. "Your Highness must not drink of the water here," said Odo, releasing her hand. She gave him a quick derisive glance. "Ah, true," she cried. "This is the house to which that abandoned wretch used to lure poor Sir Venno." She drew back to look at the lodge. "Were you ever in it?" she asked curiously. I should like to see how the place looks." She laid her hand on the door latch, and to Odo's surprise it yielded to her touch. "We're in luck, I vow," she declared with a laugh. "Come, cousin, let us visit the Temple of Romance together." The allusion to Sir Venno jarred on Odo, and he followed her in silence. Within doors, the lodge was seen to consist of a single room, gaily painted with hunting scenes framed in garlands of stucco. In the dusk they could just discern the outlines of carved and gilded furniture, and a Venice mirror gave back their faces like phantoms in a magic crystal. "This is stifling," said Odo impatiently. "Would your Highness not be better in the open?" No, she persisted. "You unbar the shutters and we shall have air enough. I love a deserted house. I have always fancied that if one came in noiselessly enough, one might catch the ghosts of the people who used to live in it." He obeyed in silence, and the green filtered forest noon filled the room with a quiver of light. A chill stole upon Odo as he looked at the dust-shrouded furniture, the painted harpsichord with green mold creeping over its keyboard, the console set with empty wine flagons and goblets of Venice glass. The place was like the abandoned corpse of pleasure. But Maria Clementina laughed and clapped her hands. "Tea, this is enchanting," she cried, throwing herself into an armchair of threadbare damask, "and I shall rest here while you refresh me with a glass of Lacrima Christi from one of those moldy flagons. They are empty, you say? Never mind, for I have a flask of cordial in my saddle bag. Fetch it, cousin, and wash these two glasses in the spring, that we may toast all the dead lovers that have drunk out of them." When Odo returned with the flask and glasses, as he had brushed the dust from a slender table of inlaid wood, and drawn a seat near her own, she filled the two goblets with cordial and signed to Odo to seat himself beside her. "Why do you pull such a glum face?" she cried, leaning over to touch his glass before she emptied hers. "Is it that you are thinking of poor Cerveno? On my soul, I question if he needs your pity. He had his hour of folly, and was too gallant a gentleman not to pay the shot. For my part, I would rather drink a poisoned draught than die of thirst." The wine was rising in waves of color over her throat and brow, and setting her glass down, she suddenly laid her ungloved hand on Odo's. "Cousin," she said in a low voice, "I could help you, if you would let me." "Help me?" he said, only half aware of her words, in the warm surprise of her touch. She drew back, but with a look that seemed to leave her hand in his. "Are you mad," she murmured, "or do you despise your danger?" "Am I in danger?" he echoed, smiling. He was thinking how easily a man might go under in that deep blue gaze of hers. She dropped her lids, as though aware of his thought. "Why do you concern yourself with politics?" she went on with a new note in her voice. "See, can you find no diversion more suited to your rank and age? Our court is a dull one, I own, but surely even here a man might find a better use for his time." Odo's self-possession returned in a flash. I am not," cried he gaily, "in a position to dispute it at this moment," and he leaned over to recapture her hand. To his surprise, she freed herself with an affronted air. "Ah," she said, "you think this a device to provoke a gallant conversation." She faced him nobly now. "Look," said she, drawing a folded paper from the breast of her riding coat. "Have you not frequented these houses?" Suddenly sobered, he ran his eye over the paper. It contained the dates of the meetings he had attended at the houses of Gamba's friends, with the designation of each house. He turned pale. "I had no notion," said he, with a smile, "that my movements were of interest in such high places. But why does your highness speak of danger in this connection?" "Because it is rumored that the Lodge of the Illuminati, which is known to exist in Pianura, meets secretly at the houses on this list." Odo hesitated a moment. "Oh, of that," said he, "I have no report. I am acquainted with the houses only as the residences of certain learned and reputable men, who devote their leisure to scientific studies." "Oh," she interrupted, "call them by what name you please. It is all one to your enemies." "My enemies?" said he lightly. "And who are they? Who are they?" she repeated impatiently. "Who are they not? Who is there at court that has such cause to love you? The Holy Office? The Duke's party?" Odo smiled. "I am perhaps not in the best odor with the church party. Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.